Testing, 1, 2, check. Testing, 1, 2, check. Morning. Testing, 1, 2. Microphone at all? Can't hear the microphone. No? Let's try this one here. Not so worried about in here, but on the stream. Testing, 1, 2. Check. Testing, 1, 2, check. Okay, sounds like it's going over the system. Just a moment. Checking. Check. It may be a bit low today, but I think we're just going to have to deal with it. Okay. Then let's go ahead. Start this. Yes, welcome to the seventh and last tutorial for the Data Science and for Security and Forensics course. Today we really are mostly just talking about clustering and these kinds of algorithms. Before I want to get to the actual kind of content of the lecture, I just wanted to cover some reference group feedback I've gotten so far. One of the folks was saying that one of the lectures was not recorded. Have you noticed this as well? I can double check with Andre, but I still need to do so. Okay, so I'll figure that out. Another item was that some of the students for the homework were saying that for the homework they kind of don't. The students don't have a good idea of a good baseline of quality for the homework. And I was wondering what would work. What could I show you that would show what a baseline quality, say, B or A homework would look like? Did you have an idea? Or?
Is it possible to send to you before the hand-in?
Yeah, you can send in things to me before the hand-in to get feedback. Okay, so that's quite all right. Because alternatively, I was thinking, well, I could show you some old homework that's been totally redacted, and so it's just like several pages of black bars, but that doesn't do much good. But yeah, feel free to send in some homework to us just to get an idea if you're going in the right direction. And I'm not going to like do a full grading or review of it, but I will go over and say, okay, this looks good or this looks bad, this needs work or stuff like this. Another item that was listed was kind of the question of it'd be good to have kind of interactive lab sessions for the homework. And I would say that's like something devoted to this we probably won't have at this point. Furthermore, we don't have any student assistance, so we don't really have much of the capacity to do so. But again, it's like feel free to contact me even in this, like after the content of this tutorial. Like, you can ask me questions about the homework, or you can just send me an email, or I have office hours on Wednesdays between 10 and 12 that I just say, if you ask me things during that time, I just try to respond as best as possible. So for now, I think we can try to utilize these. Another item was about labeling of Blackboard material by content. So I think in the future, it's a bit late now, but so we upload a variety of different file types. For instance, I'm uploading like Word document files, Andre's uploading PDFs, I'm uploading PowerPoint files, etc. As of now, well, I think for the rather than the document files, may just upload PDF files. But for the tutorials, I like to upload them as PowerPoints because the GIFs are interactive. If you upload a PDF with a GIF, it's just a picture, a static picture. Let's see here. Oh, actually, I got these two items mixed up. There's also kind of a request for labeling Blackboard material by content. So, like, rather than just the weeks, we can do say that this contains this or that. We may try to do that. I need to figure out maybe the best way to do it. But in the meantime, I know that in Andre's lectures, in most slides in the beginning, he has kind of the course schedule by week, which is organized by the topic of the content we're going to cover. And furthermore, in the syllabus that I uploaded to the course, it also tries to cover week by week what the content we cover is. So at least for now, those can be your options. But yeah, let's go ahead and continue on with the actual subject. So, what is clustering, and how does it differ from classification? Just at a kind of general understanding, yes. Yeah, you're looking for collections of data points, yeah. And more or less, these collections should have strong associations with each other and distinct associations with other clusters. That's really the big idea of clustering. How does it differ from classification? It's not labeled. Yeah, exactly. So whereas classification is all about making predictions on certain samples that you feed it, and generally you have essentially some number of classifications you can give these samples, clustering is really about just finding these clusters, these sets of samples which are highly associated with each other and ideally not so associated with the other items. So I think we covered most of the content. This is just an example of applying clustering to this group of data where we said, okay, we're going to have three different clusters, and you can see this is kind of like a hard decision kind of clustering algorithm, maybe something like k-means that we'll talk about later, so there's no overlapping between the different clusters. But generally speaking, you can kind of see, just looking at the clusters that this algorithm identified, that, yeah, I can see how these data points here form a cluster which is kind of compact and distinct from, say, the other clusters that were formed. So we covered most of these points. Clustering, it's unsupervised learning. We don't need to know the sample labels or classes. It reveals structures in unlabeled, unclassified data sets. Where these different groups or structures are based on some sort of dissimilarity or similarity measure, such as distance, which is the typical one, the Euclidean distance. And I've been kind of getting to these points of what makes, like, for clusters that are generated that you can have confidence in. But essentially, it's these following items. So clusters, ideally, they have high intercluster distance. So say my hands are two different clusters. Ideally, if you want confidence in the clusters generated, your clusters should be distinct from each other. And then they should have low intercluster distance. They should be compact. So you can have more confidence in generated clusters that are more like this as opposed to, say, like this. And of course, some data doesn't really naturally lend to these properties well. So we're essentially looking for clusters that optimize these properties as best as possible given our different learning methods. So we're going to see some examples of this for the different algorithms. So for instance, I mean, we have a pretty high confidence on the clusters, say, being assigned on the left side. They're dense and they're distant from each other, as opposed to this clustering over here, where you can take a look at it and you say, well, there's some interesting clustering assignments being done over here. Potentially even you've chosen the wrong number of clusters on the right-hand side. And we're going to talk about choosing different, kind of trying to optimize the choice of the number of clusters a bit later on as well. So we talked about the difference between classification and clustering. And the slides have also included a very short Google Colab demo that we can just take a quick look at. So here is just an example that you can use to show how to... This is also showing you how to generate some random blobs of data, but it is also showing you how to utilize sklearn for applying k-means clustering. So what I just did here is I made three essentially blobs of data using three Gaussian distributions. That's all this is describing. So this is the means of the distributions, and here's the standard deviations of the distributions as well. And I'm just doing it for the sake of example. This is just a pre-processing step to isolate the different features. And I've just randomly generated three different clusters based on these Gaussians. So it looks like a big blob here, but the way that it was generated is that essentially there's one random set of data being generated over here, one random set of data being generated over here, and also one being generated over here. So like we kind of know that there are three clusters in this data, even though right now I'm not saying that they have any labels, right? So if we can then apply something like k-means on the data to do this unsupervised learning, and it's very simple. You just import it, for instance, from this sklearn library. I'm mentioning this too because I think in one of the homeworks I ask you to use a k-means clustering algorithm, so this is a way to do it. And we'll talk about this a bit later, but here are some variables you can set in it, such as the number of clusters, the random seed, essentially, things like this. And I've drawn, using matplotlib, the two clusters identified from this data. So this is how this k-means clustering will work if I say there's only two different clusters, right? And if you look at the data, you say, okay, well, given two clusters, that makes sense. These clusters are decently dense, maybe not the most dense, and decently distinct. I mean, they don't say this crossover point is in one of the better points that could be. But we can get really different results if we change the number of clusters. So now we're getting... This is our results. So by just choosing, say, a different number of clusters, we get something that looks a bit more distinct. And furthermore, you can get you should be able to get different results by changing the initial random state. So here you can see, if you recall, there was a different membership between the reds and the blues in the previous time we did the clustering here. So this is just changing some hyperparameters, usually like the starting points of the centroids. So my point here is that depending upon how you set up your hyperparameters when you run the algorithm, you're going to get different results, right? Of course, if the hyperparameters are all the same, it's a deterministic algorithm. It's going to run the same, but different hyperparameters, different results. Just as an aside for right now, I was starting to set up this example from the CHEO book from Chapter 6, where it's about clustering good and toxic domains based on some features you can extract from the data. But they decided that they didn't want to have the entire example there. So I've just started the example for you for instance, just extracting the actual domains and putting it into a data frame. So you have these domains which are, say, toxic and which are good. And then the next steps, which it really only outlined in text but not in an actual application, I've kind of written some potential things you can follow to try to extract the other features to do the clustering on this. Some other features it's wanting to extract is, for instance, percentage of vowels that are in the domain names, the age of the domain, the first n letters of the domain, so on and so forth, and some you'll have to do some transformation of the data from categorical to numeric, like using one-hot encoding. But I'll leave that to you if you want to follow up on that. But generally speaking, any questions about the general concept of clustering before we get into more specifics? No? If not, then we'll move on for now. So by now you should be familiar with at least a couple different methods of clustering. Which type of methods of clustering are you familiar with? Either from kind of a more generic approach or even from a more specific algorithmic approach. So there's k-means, yes, and this is one of these types of clustering methods that we call a partitional method. There's kind of another type of method as well that was covered in the last lecture. So Gaussian is also, so Gaussian mixture models is a soft clustering approach, which is also partitional. So I'm actually driving at here hierarchical clustering, which was covered in the previous lecture. So what was mentioned was k-means, and this picture was taken from the book, and when it says this item here, it's really talking about Gaussian mixture models. So these are kind of, I'd say, the two main approaches for clustering, hierarchical and partitional. And even later, we'll see the differences in these different algorithms like k-means and Gaussian mixture models and stuff like this. But in a lot of ways, they follow kind of the same approach. They all can be kind of described in terms of k-means in a way, as opposed to hierarchical clustering, which is a bit different. Remember, this was kind of the tree-based clustering. Does anybody remember kind of one of the advantages of hierarchical clustering? Yeah. So you're saying you can kind of determine the number of clusters. You don't have to. It's not like the partitional approaches where you typically have to have a guess in the beginning of the number of clusters. Hierarchical approaches will create these trees of different clusters, where then basically when you look at these trees of clusters, you can then say, oh, okay, if I draw the line here, then I just want this many clusters in the end. So you can apply hierarchical approaches without, at the beginning, having an explicit idea of how many clusters are necessary or what are the appropriate number of clusters before doing the clustering. This is just the book definition for partitional clustering by Kononenko. Yeah, so it's saying that it's a series or family of algorithms that produce a partition of examples into a specified number of clusters by either minimizing or maximizing some numerical criterion. And this is true, but in many times, especially for things like k-means, we even see that the algorithm is a bit heuristic, a bit rule of thumb. But generally speaking, partitional clustering, especially k-means, this is much more popular than hierarchical clustering, at least that I've seen. In most papers, you see methods more akin to k-means or Gaussian mixture models. I just want to reference this mode-seeking one, which I think is... So these other ones are dealing with like the average of the data. This is dealing with the mode, the most present type of feature given some sample set. And I think this is for dealing with things like categorical data. So most cases, when you're doing partitional clustering, you're going to be using some kind of distance numeric features. Other things with partitional clustering is that you must assign the number of clusters prior to training. So this is a hyperparameter, which can be a bit annoying. As we saw before, you can get really different kind of usefulness or performance based on the number of clusters you choose. So before going into things like hierarchical clustering, I want to get into the details of k-means clustering, because I think k-means is, if there's anything you should take away today, just kind of, it should be understanding, generally speaking, like what k-means is and how it works. So, can anybody describe to me the general flow of like the k-means algorithm? We can go over it. What about when can k-means essentially fail or get some really bad results? When the centers of the clusters are not found properly. So let's ask, when can that occur? Because this is kind of what does cause the problems, is where the centroids end up being. But why might this be the case? Wrong number of clusters, that's very true. Especially if you have too many clusters given your data, this can be an issue. Then also even just the initial positions of your clusters. Sometimes you get, say, unlucky, or maybe you start off with two clusters being very near each other, and they don't find their local minimum in the ideal way. Because that's what the k-means algorithm is. It's a method to find a local minimum. So let's go over kind of the k-means clustering algorithm summary. And while I kind of walk through these steps here, I'm going to show this picture on the next slide. So first thing you do is you have this hyperparameter k. You have to choose. So you have to choose a number of clusters. And then you need to initialize random k-centroids. You need to place them in, say, some semi-random positions on your actual data set. And the best practice is to place them quite far away from each other as possible when you start out. So this is an example here. And say we initialize our centroids. Let me find my mouse. Can you see it on the screen? Good. Maybe I'll even do some drawing. So we have our initial centroids here and here, right? So then you're going to do this for some number of iterations. What you're going to do is to partition the data points to the closest centroid. So basically, for every single data point, you're going to say, is this centroid or this centroid closer? And then you're going to say, okay, this centroid is closer, so for now, this data point is going to be associated with, for now, let's just call it the red cluster. And this data point says, oh, I'm closer to the red one. I'm closer to the red one, I'm closer to the red one, et cetera, et cetera. And likewise for these data points too, they've discovered that they're closest to the centroid over here, right? So on and so forth. Now what you do is you recalculate the centroid positions based on your current data points assignments. So now after all your samples have, say, decided I am closest to this centroid, therefore we are a cluster, then what you do actually is you note, okay, our current centroid really is not the centroid of our given clusters. We need to actually recalculate what the center of this cluster is. And that's what's going on here. So based on these samples here, we've said, okay, we need to recalculate essentially our mean position. So that's what this centroid is doing here, recalculating its position here. And likewise for the yellow cluster, the actual true centroid position given the kind of current clustering is actually over here. Does that make sense? You're recalculating the center of your clusters, essentially. And basically, what you do is you repeat this until convergence. Basically, until clusters no longer are switching any members between each other. And it's really that simple. So, you see here, this is the new position of our centroid. And again, in the second iteration, we're saying, let's for each sample, let's decide which cluster or centroid it's closer to. And you can see even for some of these red samples over here, or these samples over here, they are now red when they were previously yellow, right? They've more or less swapped membership. So every single sample here is deciding which centroid it's closer to. And again, we then have to after all the samples know which centroid is closest to, we recalculate this position of the centroid for each of our current clusters, right? So the real true center is over here. The real true center is over here, right? And this is just done over and over again, whereas you can even see in this case some sample points were kind of swapped around between different clusters. The centroids were updated. But after updating the centroids, no samples were switched between the different clusters. Therefore, you are finished. So that is when this algorithm ultimately ends. So the initial positions of the centroids and the choice k of the number of clusters are the hyperparameters of this algorithm. So does that make sense, kind of, generally speaking? And this is just another example of it. We'll watch it again, but the X's are these centroids, and you can see where they start out and how they change over time. So, for best results, ideally, you know, have a general idea of how many clusters K should be there before you apply the clustering. You're going to get better results if you have a general idea of the number of clusters in your data. And generally speaking, you don't have to be exact, but you should be on the right magnitude. So, for instance, if you can tell that maybe there's only roughly 10 different types of the data, choose 10 as opposed to 100 different clusters, for instance. And the initial centered positions will have to be placed properly or appropriately in order to get some proper divisions. And this is just an example I was showing before in the interactive example. So same number of clusters, but just different starting positions for the centroids, but you ended up with two different clustering partitions, right? And this is what we were talking about before, some possible failures for k-means. Poorly chosen number of clusters k. If you have too many, you can have too many clusters, you can have too few clusters. You can have unlucky starting positions with the centroids. And if you have, say, especially if you have too many clusters, you can even end up with clusters that are entirely empty. So just as kind of a result from the algorithm you just saw that basically the samples will say, I'm closer to all the other points and not to you, and now you essentially have a sentry sitting there doing nothing. So we kind of talked about k-means in the heuristic sense, a bit of the rule of thumb sense, but we can actually formalize it a bit more. So the k-means algorithm can actually have an objective function that you can kind of measure and show that by doing this algorithm, we are minimizing this property. So the one in particular I'm going to talk about, this is not the only objective function you can use for k-means, but it is one of them. This is the within cluster sum of squared errors function. And very much like many other the objective functions we've seen, it's a little bit similar to something like mean squared error. So basically what you're doing here is you are measuring the within cluster compactness, so how dense your cluster is. And recall, we are ideally searching for clusters that are dense. That means we want this number to be low. And generally speaking, this number is a measure of spread or variance of your clusters. So just looking at the function here below, it looks kind of scary at first, but it's not that bad, I promise. all this is saying, for all the k different clusters, you're going to be summing up these following items. And within each cluster, we're going to be looking at every single sample in that cluster. And what we're doing here is we're calculating the distance between the centroid of that cluster and the given sample within that particular cluster. And we're squaring the distance. And this is all just summed up between the different clusters. So it makes sense that the minimization of this measure will correspond to a cluster convergence. Basically, when no sample starts to trade cluster membership, we're ideally finding these clusters which are pretty compact. Hopefully also kind of isolated from each other, but this really is mostly concerned with compactness. Other methods of objective functions you can find are inertia, which is another kind of similar measure to this within cluster sum of squares, as well as variance. But all of them concern the density of the clusters or the compactness of the clusters. So basically, and you don't really need to know this when you're running the algorithm, but when you're running this algorithm, your objective function will converge to a local minimum of this type of measurement as the clusters converge. So another reason why I'm bringing this up is not only just to kind of formalize k-means into a way that is similar to other kind of learning methods we've seen, but it's also important for knowing about this elbow method, which is a method to estimate the number of clusters if you have no idea what it is. It's a very popular method, but it's also extremely informal. It's very much an educated guess, so just be aware of that. But you still find it in scientific papers. So basically, to get an idea of the proper number of k you should be choosing, you're going to be running your k-means algorithm on your data with an increasing number of k. So say you start off with, I don't think it really makes much sense to start off with one cluster, but maybe start off with two clusters, and then record the within cluster sum of squares, say for what you obtained for clustering with two clusters, and then do the same thing when clustering with three clusters, four clusters, five clusters, so on and so forth. As you can see, basically as your number of clusters increase, the kind of average or the variance of your clusters, the density of your clusters gets lower and lower. So basically, in order to guess the best number of clusters k, using the elbow method, the kind of guess here is that the best k is occurring somewhere at the elbow of this curve. So, I mean, looking at this curve here, basically the point where you say, okay, if we continue increasing the number of clusters, K, we get, say, diminishing returns on reducing our, say, measure of compactness. So just looking at this graph here, what would you guess as the proper number of clusters using the elbow method? Yeah, it's probably three or four. And that's literally, like, as messy as this kind of guessing is. I mean, you can make arguments whether it should be three or four, but roughly speaking, you can say, okay, it's around this. So that's the elbow method in a nutshell. Any questions regarding this? If not, we can continue. So that was K-means and some more maybe technical approaches, aspects of it. Now we're going to move on to just shortly hierarchical clustering and how it works. Do you remember that there's two different approaches you can do to hierarchical clustering? Excuse me, I have a cold. Does anybody remember what these are? Exactly, top down and bottom up. So the divisive approach, top down, where essentially where you start off with one big cluster and then you typically in a heuristic fashion start splitting it into smaller clusters. And then there's the bottom up approach, the agglomerative approach, where essentially everything starts out as every sample starts out as its own cluster, and then based on kind of the shortest distance between clusters, you start merging clusters together. And either way, whether you go from top down or bottom up, you're going to get a tree that you can generate. And the neat thing about this kind of tree, if my mouse decides to work, I think my finger is cold, it's not registering. Come on. There we go. I'm going to do this. So you can just apply this without having any, say, number of clusters in mind, but based on the number of clusters you generate, you can say, okay, maybe the cutoff point is here, for instance. So we'll get, say, these two clusters. Or alternatively, you can say, oh, the cutoff points should be here. So then you get these three clusters, for instance. So you can kind of inspect your data and then choose where you want to make that cutoff point to decide what the cluster should be. This is kind of a, say, Euclidean-based example when talking about the bottom-up approach to hierarchical clustering. So the way that the algorithm works, and this is dependent upon what is known as the link type, which just says, how do you measure the distance between any two different clusters? More or less, the algorithm is saying, given your data set, identify which clusters are closest, and then merge those first. And that will be, say, a certain level of the tree. And here it's saying that, okay, based on the distance between all the data points, and we can see that A and B and D and E are closest to each other, and that apparently they're also, these distances between A and B and D and E are equal to each other, so we're making this kind of connection at the same level, right? And then the next iteration, we're saying, okay, which data points are closest? In this case, it appears to be C is closest to this A and B group, so it's merged, making this new different level here. Then we can say, okay, the next closest clusters are F in this grouping of D and E, so we merge them here, right? And then finally, we connect the last two clusters together and make this connection at the top, right? So that's agglomerative clustering in a nutshell. And we want to get a little bit more technical. You can talk about the different link types. Like, why are we saying that this is the distance between the two different clusters as opposed to like this, or I don't know, like this. Well, you'd be right. There's different types of measurements that you can make. These are the definitions here, but I'm going to talk about them and show them in the next picture at the same time. So this single linkage, my nose is super blocked. This is the distance between clusters, is the minimum distance between elements in each cluster. So basically it's saying that it's given two different clusters, you just take the elements which are closest to each other from the different clusters and you make the measurement there. That's single linkage. Complete linkage is essentially the opposite, where you're taking the most distant points from cluster A and cluster B and measuring the distance between them in this fashion. And then there's kind of more obvious ones, centroid linkage, where you, say, calculate the center of each cluster and then calculate the distance between the two clusters then. And there's another one, too, which is extremely expensive, called average linkage. It says, rather than the worst or best distances, when using the average linkage criterion, we average over all possible pairs between the groups. So that's a lot of different connections, right? So you're making an average between every single possible distance between the two groups. So generally speaking, that would not be advised. And there's other types too. But this is more or less the agglomerative approach, this bottom-up approach, and the description of these linkage types. Then there's the top-down approach, which I've briefly mentioned, where you're starting off with one large cluster and dividing it into smaller clusters. So, for instance, we would start here with this big gray circle, and you have to make a decision on where to split the data and to get your divisions for your tree. And a true implementation would essentially try every single possibility of divisions that you can do. Of course, this is really, really expensive, so they generally use some sort of greedy heuristic to make these decisions on where to split on the top-down approach. And as you might guess, the bottom-up approach in terms of computational complexity is faster than the top-down approach. So this is more or less hierarchical clustering in a nutshell. I think for now, maybe we can have a 10-minute break before we go into the next content. So let's all be back here about at 10:08.
Yes, English is preferred.
Norwegian is like hierarchical data sets because I can envision some, what is it called, like web situations where probably the data point that is lower, depending on what data set, obviously, but there, you can have like.
You can draw it out. I mean, this is what I have this here for.
So let's say. You have point A, and you have point B, and you have point C. And some people might think that B is over C, and some people might think C is over B. It could be like there's no clear answer.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a ton of that. And generally speaking, whenever these like weird ties happen in these algorithms, the heuristic that they choose is usually super simple. It's like, it's usually like, oh, say this is A and also D as well. A lot of times these heuristics are like, okay, if these points to each other are, say, equidistant, and you can only merge one at a time, merge with the cluster which is smaller. Like, this is how this heuristic typically works. So I also wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of these strange scenarios in hierarchical clustering.
Yeah, I just can imagine there could be like, not like huge jumps, but like single step jumps, there could be a lot.
Yeah. And if you, like, you can create some of these hierarchical clustering dendrograms using Weka on like whatever data set you want. But these trees are huge. So like,
So it's not like the ones I'm typically drawing, but there's a lot of different levels of where you can cut them off.
But I'm guessing it doesn't really matter in the ground theme.
Generally speaking, probably not. I will say also that in most scientific papers that I read, they're using things like k-means over hierarchical approaches most times. But it probably doesn't make a huge difference, like you say.
But it could.
It could.
I was just thinking, might be theoretical.
Yeah, sure.
So it's not that, in principle, it will never be perfect, kind of.
Very rarely are these algorithms perfect.
Convergence to the global optimum.
Okay.
That one
så da blir det ikke når den satt når den tredje at jeg fant den det stod ikke
Du var ikke overbevist.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started up again. All right, so we've been talking about this similarity measure or dissimilarity measure that we use in clustering, and I just want to talk about it a little bit more. We generally have a good idea of how it is and how it's typically things like the Euclidean distance, just basically how can we measure the similarity between our samples in any kind of way. It makes sense if you have numeric features that the Euclidean distance can be something like this, that we can measure the distance between the different samples or different centroids, different clusters, things like this. I just want to quickly cover that this is not the only measure of similarity or dissimilarity that you can use. You can use other kinds of distances, things like the Manhattan distance, things we saw before with the k-nearest neighbors, Chebyshev distance. I always forget how to say this word, Mahalanobis distance. Then for things like categorical data, they can use something called the Jaccard distance, which is more or less calculating something like the intersection between two different sets, like you see in typical set theory. And just also note that if you're using distance-based measures or similarity measures, note that it may be a good idea to scale the data or scale your features such that the different features can have a fair influence over the decision of the clusters. So this is kind of like what we were talking about before with things like, I think I was showing some example maybe with k-nearest neighbors that when the different features are of different magnitudes, when you're using these distance-based functions, those magnitudes are important. The features with the large magnitudes usually typically dominate and basically end up being the only features which are deciding, say, whether the classification or the clustering. So they're dominant in the actual learning. So maybe a good idea to scale your features. Soft clustering or fuzzy clustering. So we know about Gaussian mixture models. Are there any other kinds of soft or fuzzy clustering that you know about? Or do you even know what fuzzy clustering is? How is it different from typical k-means? Yeah, so he was saying it's when you allow some overlap. Exactly. So k-means is more or less making a binary decision whether or not this sample belongs to this or that cluster. Whereas these fuzzy clustering methods, there's usually some sort of numerical metric that says this sample belongs to this cluster 35%, this one belongs to it 67%, something like this. So, right, it allows for cluster overlap as well. So this is a very important aspect, maybe one of the more important ones for fuzzy clustering. So some examples, c-means clustering, and I'm not going to go over it in depth. You can see it in the book. I would say that's, I don't see it too often in the literature. When I see fuzzy clustering, I see Gaussian mixture models more often, I would say. But c-means clustering, it's similar to k-means in that it's very heuristic and centroid-based, and you're more or less doing a similar sort of task where you're trying to minimize, say, the compactness of your identified clusters. But now each data point has a membership weight associated with each cluster. So a sample's membership for the different centroids, they all add up to one, like a probability. So this is just kind of a simple example of visualization here. So say for this sample here, it would be, I don't know, 60% green cluster, 35% blue cluster, and 5% purple cluster in terms of these kind of weights and associations. And that's another nice thing about c-means, it's kind of simple in this way. C-means also has a hyperparameter in order to control the fuzziness of your clusters. So this is another kind of headache or hyperparameter that you need to be aware of when you're setting up the algorithm that you will probably have to play around with to find something that is acceptable. Then there are Gaussian mixture models, which I'm going to go a bit more in depth, where it's a bit more formal and probability distribution based. And essentially, samples, as opposed to these probabilities that add up to one, samples have relative likelihoods that they belong to different clusters. So if you remember the probability density function for like a Gaussian distribution, if you say calculate, if you say, okay, at this point in the distribution, I can draw it out so it's not so abstract. So this is just some Gaussian distribution based on some probability density function. You just say some point here. You say, okay, at this point has some relatively likelihood equal to the height of the function at this point. That's really all that means. And unlike c-means, these relative likelihoods do not need to add up to one. Um, here are some other nice things about fuzzy clustering methods, including the Gaussian mixture model. So in this picture here, you can see that we have some spread of data, and we've decided that there are going to be three clusters using these Gaussian distributions. One thing that you can see here that never happens with k-means is that you have these overlapping clusters. So this cluster here is essentially bisecting these two other clusters. And it makes sense because you can see that there's some concentration of data here that's kind of going along this particular spread, right? If you were to apply something like k-means on this, just a second here, I scared the machine. Come on. Okay, I'll just cancel this for now. Okay, let me get the pen out as well. I shouldn't have done that. Just a second. All I wanted to do was erase the pen on here, and I've disabled the visuals. Oh, come on, don't do that to me. The projector looks like it wanted to take a nap right now. One more time. Okay. And the pen works good. Right, so if you're applying something like k-means to this data here, you would get maybe, and we're going to say just using three clusters, you would get some clusters that look like, for instance, here, maybe right up nestled up against another cluster here, and then another cluster over here. So that's the nice thing about something like c-means clustering or Gaussian mixture models is you can have a bit more nuanced clusters. Because maybe these kind of borders between these clusters here are a little artificial, right? All right, so I'm not going to try to erase that because it'll destroy the destroy what's going on here. But so Gaussian mixture models, unlike like c-means and unlike k-means, the clusters are governed by, rather than like a centroid, they have what is typically found in your Gaussian distributions, the mean, which more or less acts like a centroid, but you also take into consideration a covariance matrix. So this is just essentially the standard deviation in a multidimensional sense, right? And in terms of like membership, like I said before, each data point has a relative likelihood of being associated with each cluster based on the distributions. And I'm not going to go into this super deep, but this is also another reason why I bring up Gaussian mixture models, is because the way it learns is using another kind of optimization algorithm called the expectation maximization. And more or less, over a series of iterations, it tries to learn and adjust the mean and the covariance matrices of the different probability density functions, your different clusters, your different Gaussians. So kind of walking through just briefly how it works. So the whole goal of the expectation maximization algorithm is it's trying to fit your clusters, your Gaussians, your basically these starting points of your clusters to the data iteratively. So basically imagine that we're choosing just two different clusters to start out with, and you make a guess as to the initial position of your Gaussians. So this is just an initial position, initial guess as to where their means and standard deviations are. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. If you recall, this is the probability density function. This is the mean. This is the standard deviation. And through this process, we're updating these values here such that the Gaussians end up fitting onto the data best as possible. That's the whole objective of this expectation maximization process. So, right, first you guess these Gaussians, and then you do what is called the expectation step. So here what you're doing is you're calculating the likelihood that the Gaussians generated the data. And I'm not going to go through all the details here, but essentially what you can do is you can more or less break down the individual samples and the probability that the different Gaussians or different clusters generated that data. So I'm not going to go deep into these descriptions here. And the thing is that the likelihood that each sample acts as like an associated weight for each cluster is kind of, again, what is saying the association between the different clusters. But here's how it takes place, or its importance for the learning process, is that this is used in the maximization step. So basically, you recompute your Gaussian distributions, your Gaussians, these hyperparameters, the mean and standard deviation, based on your weighted data set, based on these likelihood estimates from each of the points. And basically, what you do then is you just go back to the expectation step, and you repeat these two steps until some sort of stopping criteria is met. So here we can see, first we generate these two different Gaussian distributions here, and each point has some likelihood, some weight of association with the yellow distribution and the blue distribution. And as you can see here, many of these data points here have a much stronger association with the blue distribution, and we can recalculate or update the Gaussians based on these distributions. In this way, is also kind of like k-means in this way. And then again, you say, okay, based on our current iteration or current step of our Gaussians and their means and standard deviations, we can calculate the likelihood that these data points were generated by each of the distributions and use that as a weight to then update the distributions. Update essentially this mean and covariance matrix standard deviation. So that's more or less how it works in a nutshell. I'm not going over a ton of the details here. Let's see here. Anything else I wanted to go over in particular? Another nice thing about Gaussian mixture models is I guess they have their own kind of somewhat unique method of trying to guess the number of K clusters that exist in the data. And you can play with that in Weka as well as a form of K-fold cross-validation. We'll be seeing that a bit later. Let's see here. I wanted to... And in terms of like an objective function that it is maximizing, it's maximizing what is called the maximum likelihood estimation. So the idea is that the found parameters of your model should maximize the likelihood that the given data was produced by the model. So ultimately, you should be ending up with these values here such that it makes sense that if you, say, were randomly generating data points from your distributions, that you may end up with these data points. So technically speaking, Gaussian mixture model is actually a generative model. Let's see here. This is going into kind of the specifics of the maximum likelihood estimation, which I think I'm going to skip. Typically speaking, what you end up doing is you derive a function called the log likelihood estimator, which is actually the value that you're trying to optimize. And I just want to show you how it looks after some number of iterations. So with k-means, we saw something like the within cluster sum of squares as a function that went down over time and converged towards zero. The thing is that because we're using logs in the calculation of our objective function, we get values which are negative. So you're actually optimizing up towards zero. So over time, this number here, given however many k clusters you're deciding to choose, should be going up towards zero. So the farther off your Gaussians are from the data in the first place, this lower likelihood that you'll have. And that makes sense, right? It's a lower likelihood that these distributions generated that data. And this is just a GIF showing kind of the learning process in action. And again, in many ways, it's very similar to k-means, functionally speaking. Any questions with respect to Gaussian mixture models? I mean, you're not going to be tested on like the details of probably things like maximum likelihood estimation or things like that. Yes.
When should you use it?
Like when should you use it over k-means?
When should I think I should use this model?
I would say if you know that the data has a strong degree of overlap, that you should use Gaussian or any kind of fuzzy kind of clustering in this case, because you'll get more useful results than essentially k-means where you might have some forced partitions between the data. But it also, you can use it sometimes, maybe even in addition to something like k-means. Any other questions? Good for now. Okay. Just the final note I have in the slides here. This maximum likelihood estimation and expectation maximization is used to train Gaussian mixture models. I should add this slide. I'm not a big fan of it. But there's some, if you want to go into the details of the algorithm, there's also a good Jupyter notebook that goes through a walkthrough of some data and applying Gaussian mixture models and explaining how it learns. Now on to some practical tasks. So the first here is just applying k-means on the following data set, where 7 samples and 2 attributes. The whole goal is just to apply it into 2 different clusters. So we probably don't need to go too much into it, but this is just to show you how explicitly k-means learns. So we're going through the steps here. Let's see, individual 1, individual 4. Okay. Yeah, there's I think with this example I was doing a bit of a strange approach to it, but I think that's fine. Let's see here, 5 and 7, 1, 1. Yeah, so here you typically maybe would not put your initial centroids on top of existing data points, but that's just what happened here. So for the moment, that's all that's going on there. So we can see we start off with centroids here and here for clusters number 1 and 2, where there's also a data point at this point as well. And all we're doing is, say, for every sample, we're just calculating the distance from the sample to each of the centroids, right? So samples 1, 2, and 3 are all going to cluster 1. So right now, this point, and this point. Right now, this point is tied between this cluster and this cluster, but we're doing a tie-breaking heuristic to deal with it. And likewise, we can see that these points here are closest to sample 2. Yeah? So these are the points that make up cluster number 2 at the moment. So for tie-breaking at the moment, what we're doing is the rule is we're assigning the sample to the smaller cluster. So this is also what I was talking to you about before. So here we can see that there's right now less members for cluster 1, and therefore we're saying, okay, you go to this cluster for now. So this is the first step for k-means after kind of initializing the centroids. And then we recalculate the coordinates for the two different centroids of the clusters here. So using elements 1, 2, and 3, we're just taking their average position. And likewise, for cluster 2, we're taking the average positions of elements 4, 5, 6, and 7, right? So essentially, we've moved from here to here and here to here. Yeah? And then the question to you is, can we stop clustering at this point, at this moment? What should the next step be?
More points and recalculate.
Yeah, so we need to recalculate the distances between each of the points, again, to each of the centroids, right? So here we repeat the step based on our new distances. And there's same assignments for each of the clusters, except for this sample element number 3, which has now changed its cluster from number 1 to number 2. So this point here was in this cluster here, but we can see that actually it's going to be taken up by cluster number 2. So then we again recalculate the updated centroids for our clusters, like so. And if you recalculate the, say, distance between each of the points and each of the centroids, you're finding that there's no new assignments to any of the samples. They're not switching. And at this point, then we can say we're done with the k-means clustering. Right? So any questions about... This is a bit of a simple example, but any questions regarding it? And right now we've all just shown the clustering in two-dimensional space, but this works in any dimensional space, three-dimensional or higher, as long as you can measure these distances between the points. and then a quick hierarchical clustering task. Essentially, we want to be performing bottom-up or agglomerative clustering on the following data points. And let's see here, is there any discussion on the choice of link, linkage? Reduce number of clusters. So right now, the choice of linkage appears to be up to you, how we're measuring the distances between the clusters. And basically, just we're saying, let's build a tree from this. Let's build a dendrogram. So here is how our data points look. And looking at these data points and assuming we're choosing single linkage kind of clustering, which, and right now, each of these are its own cluster right now, recall. Which of these data points or clusters should we merge first? Yeah, I think I'm with you. I think it's just A and B, maybe D and E later. I think that's more distant. So we're calculating the distances, which you can see is a little bit of expensive, between all these different points. We see A and B is the shortest distance between any two clusters. So using the single linkage kind of distance. So therefore we say, okay, that's a cluster. In this case, though, okay, in this case, which two clusters then should we link? And there can be more than one answer.
We have the three linking methods, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to choose single linkage, where that is the, for any given cluster, we're using the points in the cluster that are closest to the points in the other cluster.
Yeah. So that can be maybe from A, B to F,
mm-hmm.
or D to...
And I think you're right. I think it's both of these, actually. So in this case, and I'm not guaranteeing this always happens, that there's an equal distance between A, B, and F. I guess, actually, the distance between D and E is actually more distant. That's for later. Let's see here. D. Actually, no, D and E also occurs at this step as well. Excuse me. That's correct, yeah. So we're linking these up, and we're linking these up at the same level. And then the question is, okay, which clusters should we link together here? In looking at the distances between our given clusters, we have C to DE. So this appears to be the closest. So we link them up. And then we would ultimately link up these two clusters at some point, which is closest, which I think is between B and C. So let's see here. Finally, we can make a dendrogram of the clusters that we generated and kind of these different levels of where these linkages occurred. And you can see the ABF linkage occurred at the same level as the D and E linkage. And like we say, one of the benefits of hierarchical clustering is you don't, out of the box, need to know how many clusters you want to have. You can then, based on looking at the data, you can kind of draw a line and say, okay, we want this selection of clusters, for instance. So this would be ABF, DE, C. I'm not saying it is the best choice of clusters, but it's a possibility. So does this make sense? This is just a kind of showing what we already learned. Yeah, so this is the case where we cut off at this point, at these two different clusters. The last thing that we're actually going to do today is just use Weka on a particular data set from this archive we've seen before. This is a sponge data set that records these different... mostly categorical qualities of the data set. I'm not even going to get into how Weka is going to be doing the pre-processing to transform this data from categorical features into numerical features. My assumption is some one-hot encoding and similar like things. But essentially what we're going to be doing is being applying k-means and expectation maximization onto this data set. And going to be just trying clustering on this data set for a number of different choice of clusters. And we're trying to guess what is the appropriate number of clusters in the data set using both of these methods. And for k-means, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be using the ALBA method. And for expectation maximization or Gaussian mixture models, we're going to be using its k-fold method for guessing number of clusters. Basically, we're just trying to see which one, how close each of the results get to, say, the real number of categories in the data. So, I'm going to, before I kind of jump into, hopefully this doesn't tank my visuals, come back. So sensitive. Just want to show you in Weka. There we go. So I have already loaded up. Excuse me. This actually. Let's close this. I already loaded up Weka here. You go to the clustering tab. You can choose expectation maximization. And you can choose the maximum number of clusters, and if you put minus one, then it does this estimation for the number of clusters that actually it thinks exists. And then there's some other variables you can set with respect to, say, like the minimum amount of standard deviation and stuff like this. But if we just run this out of the box, it is assuming that there are four different clusters in the data, and there's roughly 71, 72 samples. And note, the log likelihood is negative 24. And for Gaussian mixture models to... they're trying to maximize their objective function, so the closer towards zero this is, then that is then it's finding its local... That is it finding its local maximum. It's a bit confusing because it's a negative. K-means, I don't know if we need to go over it so explicitly. But basically here we can just choose the number of clusters. For instance, we just let it run for two. Two clusters. And I'm trying to recall if it also outputs... here we are. Here's where it outputs the... It's within cluster sum of squared squares error value. This objective function is trying to optimize. In its case, it's trying to go towards zero. Yeah? So this is just a couple examples, but if we run it over a series of examples, like we see here, we can build ourselves a nice elbow graph based from these within cluster sum of squares. So just doing some of the choices of K, and obviously there's different the different starting points of the cluster centroids will dictate different values you get for the clusters and the within cluster sum of square values. But we can see at K equals 2, around 711. K equals 10, around 490. K equals 20, 355, K equals 50, 133, K equals 76. That's the point where just everything is its own cluster, goes towards zero in terms of the variance. So we plot the actual elbow graph of the K clusters for K clusters versus the within cluster sum of squares. And based on this graph, which is not a great graph, mind you, where would you guess the appropriate number of clusters would be? Twenty? Yeah. So that's a pretty good guess. Anybody else feel different?
10?
10? That could be a good one, too. Generally speaking, I kind of agree. I think that this point is really the start of this elbow and the point of diminishing returns. And we'll see later what the actual number of clusters or categories from the data actually is. Doing a similar thing with the Gaussian mixture model, I'm not going to go over the details so explicitly, but you can see also as you increase the number of clusters, the log likelihood value is increasing. Generally speaking. So this is at 2, this is at 10, this is at 20, and this is at 50. It's similar in this regard. Now, if you just let the algorithm run like we did in Weka, it decided that the choice is four clusters. But according to the actual data sets, there are 12 different classes in that data set. So our estimations between 10 and 20 were pretty good using the elbow method. And you might be able to get by decently well with what the Gaussian mixture model approach also did. But that's just kind of showing some ways to choose number K in action, so to speak. But yes, this is actually all I have for today. Any final questions? Next week, I believe there's going to be a session in which there's going to be a mock exam based on things we've given in the past, so be sure to turn up to that. But otherwise, I don't have anything else for you today. If you have any questions for the homework, either ask here or send me an email, and I can get back to you. But yes, thanks for stopping by, and hopefully you've enjoyed the course. Thank you.
Stop now.